About the time the last baby boomers were in diapers, the British band The Who released the song My Generation, featuring the line, "Hope I die before I get old." The guy who wrote the song will be 75 soon. The singer will be 76. Their hopes and dreams changed over time, as they do for many of us, as our bodies and brains change with age. We can't stop aging, but we have some input on how we age. Daniel J. Levitin writes about that in his book, Successful Aging. A neuroscientist explores the power and potential of our lives. Daniel J. Levitin is a cognitive psychologist and neuroscientist and prolific author. His previous books include The Organized Mind and A Field Guide to Lies, and he joined us on The Exchange to talk about each of those books. So welcome back, Daniel Levitin.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Good to be back.
So tell us about how your view
of... Good to be back in Oregon.
Oh, that's right. You spent a fair amount of time here, haven't you?
Yeah, I love the Willamette Valley. I love Ashland. Lived on the coast near Newport, went to school in Eugene, one of my favorite places.
All right. Well, good to have you back. So tell us about how your view of aging has changed as you've done more of it.
You know, it really has changed. I have to admit, and I'm somewhat embarrassed to say so, but when I was younger, I saw old people as irrelevant and in the way, much the same sentiment that Pete Townsend wrote about. You know, we talked about don't trust anybody over 30 and all of that. Certainly you wouldn't trust anybody over 70. And as I've gotten older myself and interacted with more people who are older than me, some of those experiences have been among the best and most meaningful experiences of my life. And I've come to see old age as... not a time of infirmity and decline, necessarily, although it is for an unfortunate few, but rather a time of advantages, distinct advantages. And I'm saying that not just from personal experience, but from thousands of neuroscientific papers that say so.
Well, you know, you stopped me short at talking about this as a developmental stage. I mean, we're talking late in life as a stage of brain development.
Well, yeah, because brains are constantly changing. It's not an accurate description to say that what differs between old and middle age is that the brain declines. Yeah, there's some decline, but there are other compensatory mechanisms that kick in. The brain is constantly changing. Every time you learn something new, the brain rewires itself, and in spite of the old aphorism, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. Older adults are learning new things all the time and changing their brains. And we even see older adults changing their personalities and doing new things that they hadn't done before. That's a developmental stage of the brain.
It is indeed, I guess. Let's talk about sleep in the aging brain. How important is shut-eye?
Well, you know, there are a number of myths that were exploded as I did the research for the book, and that was one of them. I had always heard old people don't need as much sleep, and that's not true. Matthew Walker from UC Berkeley, who's done a lot of work on this, as well as Robert Stickgold and others, have shown older adults do need the same amount of sleep as younger adults, 8 hours, maybe nine, like anyone. It's just that they don't get it. They don't get as much sleep because of hormonal changes in the brain, including a loss of the production of melatonin, which is what makes us sleepy, and some other problems with the chronobiological clock. But the good news is there are things we can do, and I have a whole chapter devoted to good sleep hygiene. Happy to discuss it with you in more detail if we have time, but the idea is that we do need more sleep, and we need to make sure we get it.
Okay, yeah, I do want to talk about sleep at length later. It's one of my favorite things to do still. Let's talk about one of the major things that everyone fears, which is Alzheimer's disease and dementia generally. Some general thoughts about Alzheimer's, how widespread it is, who gets it, the basics?
Well, yeah, Alzheimer's is increasingly being diagnosed, and we're seeing more cases of it. It's not necessarily that we're seeing more cases because it's growing in the number of people that get it, so much as people are living longer, and they now get that. In other words, it's not an epidemic that's spreading due to environmental causes, as far as we know. It's just that if you live long enough, you're going to get diseases that you didn't get when you were younger. We aren't very good at diagnosing it yet, and we're not at all good at curing it. There's no known cure. There are some promising treatments in their early stages that can help to stop it, slow its progression. And I think in the next 5 or 10 years, we'll see more therapeutic interventions that actually can slow it down significantly or maybe even reverse it.
The sense of epidemic about Alzheimer's, though, is it fair?
I don't think so, in that, when I think of an epidemic, I think of something that's, contagious, like a bird flu or something. Mm-hmm. Alzheimer's isn't contagious as far as we know. And as I say, more people are getting it, but people are older, too. And I think also that it's not as likely that you'll get it as many people fear. And part of this has to do with the myth of failing memory. Oftentimes, you're 70 years old, you walk into the kitchen and you don't remember why you went there. Or you lose your keys or your reading glasses and you think, I must be getting Alzheimer's, right? I mean, that's the first thought.
Yeah, it's occurred to me too, yes.
But, I'm a college professor. I deal with 20-year-olds all the time, and they show up in the kitchen and don't know why they're there, and they lose their cell phones and their keys and their glasses. They miss appointments. They show up in the wrong classroom. They're making just as many memory lapses. The difference is the stories we tell ourselves. The 20-year-old says, I must have too much on my plate, or I got to get more than 5.5 hours of sleep. And the 70-year-old says, must be Alzheimer's.
Daniel, you mentioned silos in the field of cognitive neuroscience that might be preventing some further advances. What's in those silos?
Oh, that's a really interesting and nuanced question, Jeffrey. Thank you for that. We could talk about this a long time. It's really the nature of the way science is done these days. 120 years ago, if you got a PhD in science, in any science, you knew pretty much knew all there was to be known about the major sciences. Today, you could get a PhD in biology, specializing in the visual system of the squid. That's how specialized things have become.
Wow.
And you still wouldn't know everything there is to know about the squid, let alone the visual system of lobsters or dogs or humans or the auditory system. So in my field of cognitive neuroscience, and cognitive science more broadly defined, there are people who study personality, people who study memory, other people study intelligence, other people study emotions, aging, and we tend not to talk across disciplines and communicate with each other. And I think that to some degree that's impeding progress on figuring out issues and challenges related to the aging brain, because all these things actually do work together.
Okay, so a little more cooperation might result in some greater advances, you think?
It's hard to do because the reward structure in science, that is the grant money and the promotions and the papers published, all are kind of rigged to keep people in their lane and to keep them in a narrow field. There are organizations like the AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. We're having our annual meeting in Seattle this year in February, where scientists from across disciplines come together and listen to each other's talks. And a lot of the most important learning there happens not in the talks, but in the bar afterwards as we trade beers with people outside our fields and try to stay current. But it requires a great amount of effort to do that because you're not rewarded for it within your university or within your granting organizations, typically.
Interesting. So it keeps things a little more separate than perhaps they would have been otherwise. Let's talk about some of the general thrusts of your book, Successful Aging, because there's a great question in here. Can you look at a five-year-old and tell whether they will be a successful 85-year-old? And you say, yes, you can.
Yeah, you can. It's funny. It seems a bit counterintuitive, but, you know, out of the womb, every parent knows children differ from one another, particularly if you've had multiple kids. Their infancy and toddlerhood can be very different. We're born with certain qualities and temperament and personalities. Those things can change as a result of culture, as a result of the opportunities that come along in your life. In fact, those are the three big factors that make up who we are: genes, culture, and an opportunity. 5-year-olds who have resilience, what has been called grit, who are agreeable, somewhat outgoing, but don't require too much attention, and who follow instructions, they tend to do better than in life than kids who don't have those qualities.
Interesting. So if they got all those things organized,
It doesn't mean you can't change, though.
All right. So I know that there's a section of the book where you talk about searching for a magic number of personality dimensions. Why has the search for that number been so important to so many people?
Well, you know, there's an interesting Oregon component to this, which is that much of the most important seminal work done on personality theory was done in Eugene, at the Oregon Research Institute by Lou Goldberg, and later by Sarah Hampson and Jack Digman, also at ORI. And this has its roots back to the 60s. In the early 60s, the science of personality was really just getting underway as a rigorous mathematical approach to characterizing and quantifying and categorizing the thousands of ways we humans differ from one another. And from a scientific standpoint, having thousands of variables to deal with makes it very hard to talk about it, to make predictions, to look at correlations between personality traits and other things you might care about, such as happiness, longevity, illness, income level, propensity of being put in jail, things like that. What scientists like to do for the sake of parsimony is reduce the number, whittle down the set to what we call factors that encompass the thousands into a smaller number. And I think one of the great mysteries and adventures in the history of behavioral science was the search for this number. What is the actual correct number of factors dimensions that you need to use to capture the thousands of ways that humans differ from one another? And the answer appears to be 5. There was some people advocating for 2 or 3 or for 13, but across 40 years of work now and across cultures, 5 factors capture a great deal of the complexity and nuance of how we differ from each other. Now, I hasten to add, this has been exploited for commercial purposes in a completely inappropriate way, and there's, you know, wherever there's a buck, there's somebody who might try to hoodwink you and say they're doing it in the name of science. It does not mean that there are 5 personality types, and that's the end of the story. What it means is that those thousands of different traits or individual differences we care about cluster under 5 categories or dimensions. One of them, for example, is conscientiousness, and that's a cluster of things having to do with dependability, reliability, punctuality, thoroughness, doing what you say you'll do, making an effort to do a good job rather than just an adequate job. There are hundreds of different things that cluster under conscientiousness, for example.
And then the other four in that list of five, let me go from the top. Extroversion, agreeableness, there's conscientiousness, then emotional stability, and openness to experiences. Now, how much of these change over a lifetime, particularly once we are adults, Daniel?
Well, they do change, and it's difficult to figure out what the meaning of those changes is. Some of them are culturally dependent. Some of them are actual neural changes. We do find that older adults become more tolerant and accepting of others, more compassionate. And those are qualities that cluster under agreeableness. Older adults are more agreeable. There's mixed data on whether they become more or less conscientious. In some respects, some older adults become less conscientious because they don't have to be. But those who become more conscientious often fare better because they go to the doctor when they're sick and they actually have a doctor. Things like that.
Daniel J. Levitin, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of the latest, his latest book, A Successful Aging, A Neuroscientist Explores the Power and Potential of Our Lives. You can join our conversation here on the Jefferson Exchange by phone at 800-838-3760 or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's give an example of somebody who looked like he wasn't going to be much of a success in life. He tried a bunch of businesses and by age 62, watched yet another restaurant fail and decided to start another one at that age, at 62. So what
living
happened?
Out of his car, by the way.
Really?
Homeless and living in his car.
Uh-huh. Okay. So who was the 62-year-old guy? What was the next venture he started?
This is a guy who had been kicking around from job to job. By the age of 62, he had had 25 completely different jobs. He, by all accounts, he was a failure in life. Just could never hold a job for long. But at age 62, yep, he opened up another restaurant, and it turned out to be Kentucky Fried Chicken.
So now we're talking about Harlan Sanders, really.
Yes, exactly.
Wow. So, but, you know, this is an example of the fact that you don't have to just stop where you were and assume that this is what you've done all your life is what you need to do with the rest of your life.
That's exactly right. There is a tendency, we were talking about personality factors, there's a tendency for oldsters to become more set in their ways and less willing to try new things. But for those who rage against that tendency, who fight it, the rewards are numerous and stellar. And I'm inspired by a number of people. My new hero is Julia Hurricane Hawkins.
Mm-hmm.
She's a retired school teacher from Baton Rouge who is a competitive runner at 103. She just took the gold medal in the senior games for running, and she didn't even take up running till she was 100. Prior to that, she'd been winning medals in the senior games in bicycling and other activities. But again, she didn't start competitive athletics until she was 75. She rewrote her life story. And any of us has the power to rewrite our life story. It can take some effort. It can take, you know, some help. Maybe you need training. Maybe you need therapy. But we can change. The message is we can change at any age. Take Carmen Herrera, 104-year-old painter in New York City. She didn't sell her first painting until age 81 and then went ignored until age 89. But now her work is exhibited in the Whitney. So again, somebody else reinventing herself. As Clint Eastwood told me, he's got a new film out. He says, "I don't let the old man in."
Well, as long as we're talking about well-known performers, Glenn Campbell came up in a conversation the other day, and you mentioned him in the book. Now, here's somebody who continued to do what he had been doing, but over a greater set of obstacles. What did he do late in his life?
Well, so, you know, Glenn Campbell, I think everybody knows, was a great guitarist. Many regard him as one of the great guitarists who ever lived, and a great performer. He had his own television show, the Glenn Campbell Good Time Hour, a number of hits, and he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, and he was, when confronted with the news, he decided he wanted to keep playing. He wanted to keep performing. And that turned out to be very good. That kind of activity, I think, prevented the Alzheimer's from taking him sooner than it otherwise might have. It held the Alzheimer's at bay because he was actively using his brain. But as the Alzheimer's progressed, the interesting thing is he really could still play. He didn't always know where he was. He'd lose his place in the lyrics, but and he had memory troubles, but not problems with musical memory, really. Apart from occasional lyrical problems or playing a song two times in a row because he forgot he just finished it, as soon as the song started, everything was on autopilot, and he played beautifully and movingly. And, you know, another part of the story is what we call cognitive reserve. As Glenn's own son told me, even with half a brain, he was still a better guitarist than most people on the planet. And we see that over and over again. If you're really good at something, even with cognitive decline or with brain injury, stroke or whatever, having that extra brain power really helps to mask the deficits. I think of it this way. We were talking about competitive running. If you're a marathon runner and you're running 26 miles a couple of times a week, suppose you have a really bad day, or you've got a cold, but you still want to go out, and you run for a mile. You're going to do that mile a lot better than most people because you've got some reserve.
Ah, I see now. Yeah. Now there's another musical example in here, which is not so much about damage as about just sticking to what you know. I mean, Pablo Casals. What did he say about practicing so much at age 80?
Yeah, he was asked why he practiced so much. He says, because I want to get better. and, you know, it's a wonderful story about mindset and attitude, not being complacent and looking forward rather than back. You would think that somebody like Pablo Casals, one of the great cellists who ever lived, as far as we know, would just be happy with what he had done, but no. And we see it over and over again. Placido Domingo, Andres Segovia, people who are looking forward to the next challenge. Miles Davis is, of course, the jazz example who comes to mind, wanting to constantly try new styles and expand his idea of what music is right up to the end of his life. And in our own lifetimes, we've got two remarkable songwriters who do that. One of them is Paul Simon, mm-hmm. who had who has just kept getting better and better. Starting with the release of You Were the One in the year 2000, so 15 years after the huge success of Graceland, he kept making records to relatively small audiences, but by all accounts, each was better than the last. He kept pushing himself to get better. And the second songwriter who I admire for this is Rodney Crowell, who had a number of hits in the 80s and in the 70s, covers by Van Morrison and a number of other artists covered his, the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band did Voila, An American Dream. He had a lot of hits. Bob Seger did Shame on the Moon. But starting also in the year 2000, Rodney pushed himself, and he's making music that gets better and better, both lyrically and musically, and I think will stand the test of time.
Now, I heard it said by somebody else on public radio last week, don't retire from what you're doing, retire to something. It sounds like it's part of what you're talking about here. Make sure that you got something to go to that's going to engage your mind and challenge you a bit.
Yeah, if you're lucky and you're an artist and you can keep practicing your art, don't stop. If you're in a business world or a company where you're pushed into retirement, as happens around the world, example, in Germany, a relatively advanced country, they still have mandatory retirement at 67. My own father was forced out of his job at 62. And so if you have to retire from what you loved doing and were good at, as you say, retire to something and find some other meaningful thing to do.
So I'm sorry, you're talking about your father was forced to retire at 62 and you were just starting on a story about your mother, Daniel.
Yeah, so my father was forced to retire at 62 and he didn't know what to do, and so he took the skills he had and looked for jobs and became a teacher. And at age 87 now, he's been teaching since then, since 63, and he's 87, and he just signed a 4-year extension to his contract because the students in the university love him so much. My mother is a different story. She was a writer and had published 40 novels, but at age 70, the publisher stopped wanting to take her work. And so she had to do something different, and she became a painter. And she's been painting up a storm, and they're wonderful paintings. She's shown them in galleries in Los Angeles, which means she's got to meet all new people and learn about the gallery business. So, you know, all of these are helpful. For less ambitious people than my parents, who seem to be preternaturally driven, my social circles are full of people who, in their 70s, looking for something to do, volunteer in hospitals or read to young kids in programs in the inner city. People who become active in their church or synagogue do social outreach. All these kinds of things are important. Retiring to something.
Right, right. I mean, you mentioned, for example, learning new things, and you use yourself as an example. You are an accomplished musician in your own right, but you don't play the violin. So you talk about calibrating goals. Like, for example, you would not seek to become a world-class violin soloist at your age, but you could play it. What's the more realistic goal?
Well, it's in general, we need to set realistic goals. I think most of us have a sense for what that might be, but if you can find someone who's in the field you want to enter and ask them for advice, that would be a good reality check. But, you know, the sky is the limit. There's the story of Harry Bernstein, who published his first novel, Invisible Wall, when he was 96, and he didn't even take up writing until 93. And he did it to fill the time after the loss of his wife of 50 years, Ruby. In my case, I had two realistic goals for things I wanted to do that were outside my comfort zone. One was I have a lifelong fear of heights, and so I took flying lessons and got my private pilot's license.
Wow.
As a way to do something different that was possible. I met with the instructor. He said, oh, yeah, I can teach a 60-year-old to fly a plane. No problem. And that worked out fine. The other thing I was uncomfortable with was, although I love music and had been writing songs my whole life, I'd never really played them for anybody, and I had never been the front person in a musical group. I either worked in the recording studio in the booth there with the engineers, or I played on recordings in the background while someone else took the spotlight. And the idea of being a singer-songwriter terrified me, but I felt it was a reasonable goal. And so I got some instruction. I got some mentors who helped me to become a singer-songwriter. I was extraordinarily lucky to have as my mentors Joni Mitchell and Rodney Crowell and
can't
Paul
hurt.
Simon. Rodney and Paul and Joni taught me how to approach songwriting, and in a couple of cases actually sat down with particular songs and gave me advice. And then Joni taught me how to sing them in a way that would put them forward. And so Although it was terrifying, I just did a two-week tour last April of my songs with Victor Wooten's band. I did a show last night in New York City with a band I put together to present my new material, and got an album coming out tomorrow called Turnaround that'll be available on Spotify and iTunes and Google Play, and so we'll see.
Wow, congratulations. I see you're going to be in New York at the Strand tonight and at the Institute for Music and Neurological Function tomorrow.
You know, the thing about the comfort zone is it was very uncomfortable to be in a studio and have the spotlight on me. It wasn't uncomfortable to be on the stage and have the spotlight because the audiences were very forgiving and accepting. And I went into it having had recorded the songs and gotten feedback from people like Joni and Graham Nash and Donald Fagen of Steely Dan, Victor Wooten, all of whom said they really thought that I had achieved, you know, that I had pulled it off. They liked what they heard. And so that kind of support from people I care about really meant a lot, and I think gave me the boost to go out and try it.
Now, for the rest of us, it might not be as talented as Daniel and Jay Levitin. I mean, how do we handle the things that we just see happening to us on a daily basis? You said don't get worried about losing your keys and stuff because you have lots of experience with people in college who in their 20s doing the same sorts of things. But I mean, is it fair to think that like part of the reason we forget stuff is because at our age there's so much more to remember?
That's absolutely right. There's no evidence that our brains actually are not capable of remembering as we get older. It's just, in the technical sense, we don't have trouble getting the information in as much as we think we do. It's getting it out, and the difficulty is that it's competing with a whole bunch of more information that we're trying to get out, a kind of a bottleneck forms, which is why we end up with these tip-of-the-tongue problems where you just can't find a word or a name. But that doesn't necessarily signal Alzheimer's.
You know, I have to share a story with you because I almost shared it during our automotive segment today because we were talking about when cars give you shocks. I had gotten really annoyed at myself at the post office a few years ago because I couldn't remember my PIN to be able to buy stamps. And so I just stormed off and left. And the next day, as I was passing the post office, I accidentally leaned out the open window and touched the car body and gave myself a shock, at which point I remembered my PIN instantly and went to the post office and bought those stamps. I mean, was this just a coincidence, you think?
No. You know, the electrical shock could have actually caused some electrical activity in your brain that jogged your memory. Hard to say without having had you hooked up to equipment. But, yeah, those kinds of things happen. We do lose words and numbers, but they come back to us. There really is a myth of failing memory among oldsters. It's been completely overblown, and the research data don't support it. If you control for the testing environment, the way we test memory in most oldsters is very stressful for them. And if you give them the kind of stress-free experience you give a 20-year-old or a 40-year-old in a situation, most oldsters do just as well. They're a little bit slower, but they remember just as much. You know, the other factor is, as you say, the stories we tell ourselves. The 70-year-old thinks it's Alzheimer's when they forget a name. The 20-year-old just thinks they've got too much on their plate.
Good thing to remember. Let's take a call here. Vince in Eugene, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Daniel Levitin, the author of Successful Aging.
Hi there. Yes, I just wanted to relate that I've discovered something about getting older. I'm 68. I was a college counselor in San Diego. I was a counselor for over 1,000 college students with disabilities every semester and was really struggling the last couple of years to retain all the information. So I decided to retire and moved here to Eugene and was looking for some kind of volunteer work to do, and I discovered a program called Middle School Mentoring, where you get hooked up with a young person or two, and you spend lunch breaks with them to try to be a friend and mentor, companion. And I did that for a couple of years, and then I was discovering I was having difficulty with a physical disability and remembering, and I thought that wasn't fair to the students. And when they both graduated on to high school, I decided to stop doing it and was trying to think of something else to do. And then I thought, what I would really like to do is travel to Italy, but physically I'm not able to do those big trips anymore. And I decided to check out the University of Oregon's OLLI program, Older Learning Program, and they had, by coincidence, an Italian culture class, and my family background is Italian. So I signed up for the course last August, and I've just been amazed how much I'm enjoying it, because the teacher's going each week through a different region or city or province of Italy, and it's been like I've been traveling to Italy all over again.
That sounds great, Vince. Thanks for sharing the story. Daniel, talk about the benefits of the kinds of things that Vince is doing.
Well, all of these are very important. Learning new things is a very important and overlooked part of staying healthy and keeping a healthy brain, interacting with other people. What you and I are doing right now, Jeff, is the most complicated cognitive operation we know of.
Conversation.
Having a conversation. Yeah, conversation. I've got to think about what you said. You've got to think about what I said. We have to practice compassion. There's a certain amount of empathy and turn-taking and all of these kinds of things. It's more complicated than rocket science. It's more complicated than brain surgery or being a concert pianist. And what our caller is talking about is interacting with other people, learning new things. Travel is very important to help us to see other perspectives and see the world differently.
Well, and
all
there
of
is,
that helps to rewire the brain.
Indeed, and there's a whole coach principle that you provide in the book, which goes into the acronym curiosity, openness, associations, conscientiousness, and healthy practices. Let's talk about the healthy practices, because you got a good section on that in the book. Diet, exercise, and sleep, no surprise here. Exercise in particular, how do you find the balance between what the brain and body need and what you're capable of?
Well, so, you know, it turns out, and there's a lot of new research on this that may not have trickled down to the average person. You can always do more exercise. You can spend more time on the stationary bike or the treadmill. You can lift more weights. You can run farther. But the biggest difference in health outcomes, the biggest factor, is the difference between doing something and doing nothing. And the something can be a lot less than you might think. You know, a lot of, especially around New Year's, a lot of people are beating themselves up because they didn't stick to their exercise regimen during the year, and they're gonna buy gum. They're gonna do different this time. But all of that's good. But the real thing to focus on is that even just 10 minutes of walking, as opposed to doing nothing, and it doesn't even have to be power walking. Movement is tremendously helpful. Our bodies evolved to move, and if you can walk in nature and unpaved trails, that's even better. Anything can happen there. There's a lot of adjustments you need to make to do that. And if you're interested in the cardio side of things, which oxygenates the blood and is good for heart health, there's this relatively new idea of the high-intensity interval training, HIIT, where you really don't have to work more than 10 minutes a day, but you know, maybe you get your heart rate up to its maximum for 30 seconds, you stop for a minute and a half, you do that again. That has enormous benefits. And a lot of people don't want to exercise because they say they don't have the time, but I think everybody's got 10 minutes four times a week.
Absolutely. And then now let's talk about the brain suppleness part before we have to go, which is soon. Crosswords and Sudoku. As you point out, you're going to get better at crosswords and Sudoku, but is that going to do much to improve your brain function or keep it supple?
There isn't really any evidence that it does. That doesn't mean that it doesn't. We just don't have any scientific basis to believe that it does. Now, if you've never done crosswords or Sudoku, doing them might exercise some new circuits in your brain, and that's a good thing. And I do crosswords because I find them enjoyable, and there's a small amount of evidence that doing them will help me with word fluency so that I don't get tripped up as often as I might. But, you know, that there's not enough evidence to do it for that. I do it because it's enjoyable.
All right, the book is called Successful Aging, A Neuroscientist Explores the Power and Potential of Our Lives. Daniel J. Levitin, its author, our guest. Thank you so much for joining us once again.
Oh, thanks for having me back.
All right, take care.